Couple of announcements. You'll make a note on your calendar, July 2nd through the 8th, which is a Sunday through the Saturday. I'm going to take a week off there. Matter of fact, pray about it. I'm considering taking a week off every quarter, maybe the first week of every quarter. I don't know. We'll figure out. One of the things we're trying to do is coordinate this with when we have prep school. I don't want to cancel that Sunday, so I don't know how y'all feel about sleeping in Sunday, but I liked it. It's fun. I woke up that morning, it was a quarter of 10, and I told Linda, well, we wouldn't have made it to class anyway. She said, no, you were sound asleep. So the 2nd through the 8th, and we will have class on the 9th, so make a note of that. Also, we've been working on a deal where we, inevitably, no matter how many times I go over this, and by the way, by the time you see the notes, I've probably been over them 3 or 4 or 5 times. Somebody else has been over them once. And we still come up with various little typos and words that shouldn't be there, or you know, spell checker won't distinguish between of and or because they're both words. So if somebody would take on the responsibility, and you probably would have to do this with a hard copy of notes, to make these corrections in class, and then you have the Word file already. Well, you should have, because I send them out to you, so if you don't have them, there's something wrong. And if you can make the corrections that you catch in class, you know, with a highlighter or something so you know where they are and can find them readily, and then correct that Word document and send it to Rich, he will handle replacing all the documents we have that have typos in them. I mean, we're never going to be perfect, but it just drives me nuts to go online, and I see it all the time even still. I'll go online and I'll say, oh, this should have been changed, you know. So if someone wants to take that on, see Rich. And like I said, you'll have to keep a hard copy of notes in class, I would think. Make your little marks and corrections as you go, then fix the hard copy of the doctrine or the teaching, the whatever passage we're in, Romans 16, say. And then again, after correcting that, send it to Rich. He'll take care of uploading it, getting it on the website and all that. So if somebody will volunteer for that, I would be greatly appreciative. So that's all we have now. Let's get back to this. Dealing with this matter of boasting. This doctrine's relatively short, so I don't know that we can wrap it all up in one day, but we really want to focus primarily, I do, on the positive aspects of this anyway. But sadly, when it comes to the Bible, most of the boasting is sinful, so it predominates. So sinful boasting, Roman numeral 3, major point here. A sinful boasting is a verbal sin sponsored by the mental attitude of pride or arrogance. James 3:5. James is not a guy who minces words. And is pretty straightforward with his criticisms when he utters them. So also the tongue is a small part of the body. The idea that a part of spiritual maturity we have to look out for. First he warns in verse 1 for not many people to become teachers. Because there is a stricter judgment on them. We hold our leaders to higher standards, and rightly so. Now, we're never going to have perfect leaders. You're never going to have a perfect pastor or deacon. But as long as we're all growing believers, I'm content with that. As long as we're still doing what we're doing, and advancing spiritually, and growing, and covering the text, I'm happy with that. I don't expect to have perfect believers. But we do have higher standards. This is seen in, for instance, 1 Timothy 3 there, when you get into the office of pastor and deacon. Why? The standards are higher for them. If you want to aspire to these offices. And again, it doesn't mean you have to be perfect. My read on these is that in both of these cases, in these offices, there are, let's just say for the sake of the argument, there are 20 qualifications. And you go through, to me, the way I've done it, is you go through and you look at a man, you grade him. Okay, maybe he gets an A here, an A here. Maybe he's weak, gets a C plus in some area that he needs to work on. But other than that, he's doing his job and otherwise advancing spiritually. Well, to me, as long as they've got an acceptable grade at the end of the day, I'm okay. I don't expect them to be perfect. And again, don't expect me to be perfect because I've got areas I'm still working on. So I'm aware of what the godliness code is. I'm aware of when I fail, and so I work on it. I assume that's what everybody does. That's what we're supposed to be doing anyway, not just me. So we get a stricter judgment, though, because the standards are higher. Again, I look at it, you don't have to be perfect in an area. You could have one area of even great weakness, but it wouldn't disqualify you to my thinking. Again, the areas and the weaknesses, what they are, have to be approached kind of individually. The personality of the guy's got to be taken into account, level of service, years of service, quality of service, you know, those things all matter to me. And so I'm willing to overlook some things simply because if you've got somebody who's faithful and loyal and does their job, they may need to grow in an area, but so what? Who doesn't? We all do. So to me, we all stumble, he says here, in many ways. And if anybody doesn't stumble in what he says, he's a mature man. Not perfect in the sense of sinless. But able to bridle the whole body as well. And then he talks about the tongue and how it relates to this matter of boasting. So also the tongue is a small part of the body. And yet it boasts of great things. See how great a forest is set aflame by such a small fire. And the reality is that once the tongue has said it, it can't be unsaid. Once it's out there, it's out there. And so the problems that come out of this, the sins of the tongue, but often boasting is one of them. Also 4:16. This is talking about people who've got their financial world planned out, they think. They've got it all laid out. They know how it's going to go in the future. They've got it all planned. And he says, you know, your ideas, you don't know what tomorrow holds. You're not familiar with where God's plan's going even. So basically it was these people that sort of said, well, come now, you who say, verse 13, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. And the transient nature of human life, people don't like thinking about it. It's something that's constantly on my mind. We are not here very long. This is our time in the angelic conflict. We're either going to stand up and do it right, or we're going to be among the masses that didn't. And so this is why we set high standards. We don't apologize for that. We have 5 Bible classes a week. We don't apologize for that. I would like you to be here for every one of them. Don't apologize for that. And the reality is, I don't want to lower the standards. I don't see any reason for this. We may not always live up to everything we know in our best selves, but we're probably doing better than those that aren't being taught. If you stay on top of your sin nature and walk in fellowship, you're probably getting a lot of reward. Hopefully so. So again, you don't know. You're just a vapor. As Solomon says, life is transient. It goes by quick. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. It's all been done before. Everybody thinks, oh, this is all new. Did you see this twerking? This is all new. Nobody's ever twerked before in the history of man. No, somebody does something new or stupid and people think, oh, this is great. This has never happened. It's all just repackaged the same old devil stuff, basically, is all it is. He just repackages it, puts a new name, says new and improved on it, and people like it. But that's just good advertising. You know? So he says, look, you better say this. Your life's going by quick. You better say, if the Lord wills, we will live and we will do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. And all such boasting is evil. So everything has to be, again, all of our details, money, everything has to be held with an open hand. And whatever God wants you to do in this and that, in your livelihood and all of that, you have to constantly say, well, God, I want your will in this. I want to do what you want me to do. and be where you want me to be. Because that's where the place of blessing is. So, B, this activity, while common among the human race, is predicted to intensify as the end of all things draws near. 2 Timothy 3:2, this is our passage with regard to the last days. Men will be lovers of self, lovers of money. We don't see that much. Boastful, arrogant, revilers, and then this list goes on and on. And again, these vice lists are not meant to be comprehensive. They have some things they'll deal with and others that they don't. So see, when one considers the biblical warnings against boasting and the situations in which boasting is likely to occur, the believer should take notice and seek to avoid them. If you know that people are already tending to do this, I've never been to a sports bar in the midst of some big game in which eventually a fight didn't erupt. Why? Because people are arrogant. And they're out there and they're bragging about their team and this and that. And so stay away from those places at that time. This is not hard. You're not missing out on anything except potential for, you know, getting into a fight and violence and all that might mean. Maybe you'll spend a night in jail. You know, I can sit at home and watch the game. You know, I don't have to be out with a bunch of drunken buffoons to have fun. If I do that, I'll call some of you and we can go out. I'm kidding. Once again, kidding. So avoid them. If you know that people tend to be arrogant, they tend to be boastful, avoid those types of people. People that are not consistent in Bible class, avoid them. People that don't pursue doctrine. These are, unfortunately, your spiritual enemies. Even if they may be your relatives or your friends. That's the sad thing. Well, D, specific areas that may contribute to or constitute sinful boasting. One, human intelligence or level of secular education. And our world is big on this. Our world acts as though education is the be-all and end-all of life. If you just go out and go to college and get an education, your life will be good. You'll make more money than the less college-educated guy makes. Well, maybe. Maybe not. Maybe you'll be saddled with hundreds of thousands of dollars of bills that you're not going to be able to pay off for the rest of your life. So people make borrowing in this money in this world way too easy. So college loans. Yeah, how many of those are in default? Our government's not very smart about this stuff. Why? Because they've convinced people that education's the be-all and end-all of the human experience. That if you just get enough education, you are guaranteed a job and happiness and all the great American dream. And that's just not true. There's only a certain amount of education you actually need in this world. There's one guy, wrote a book, I can't remember who it was. He said, everything I learned about life, I learned by the time I was in kindergarten. And he said, one of the things I learned was take a nap in the afternoon. So, how much education, I mean, obviously you need to know more than kindergarten, not being facetious, but how much do people really need to know? If you can give me the atomic weight of every element on the periodic table, so what? I'll applaud you. That's good. That's great. If you can explain to me all the physical chemistry and physical physics formulas and all that, Avogadro's law and how these all things relate to the world. How often do you use Avogadro's law, by the way, when you're shopping for groceries? Never. And this is why people didn't want to learn in school. Even in high school, they were saying, I don't need geometry. I don't need to be able to do theorems or prove anything. I don't need to be able to think logically. Well, hey, you kind of do. You kind of do need to be able to. So some education, we're all for that. But education that takes people out of Bible class, where's the priority here? What's more important, spiritual or physical? That's not good. And people pursue these agendas and they think, well, this impresses God somehow. Or other people. Maybe they're only out to impress other people. Jeremiah 9, 23. Thus says the Lord, let not a wise man boast of his wisdom, and let not the mighty man boast of his might. Let not a rich man boast of his riches, but let him who boasts boast of this, that he knows and understands me. So I may not be the smartest guy on the planet. I may not be the richest guy. I may not be the most successful guy, but I know the Lord, and that's what matters. That's what we should boast in. our understanding and application of the truth. And we're not here just to teach people about God. This is the fundamental problem with churches in general. They're trying to teach people about God. We're trying to teach you to know God, to have a relationship with Him, to understand what it means to walk with Him on a daily basis, to be sensitive to the leading of the Spirit, and to grow up spiritually to attain great glory for eternity. That's what we're shooting for. You can also see 1 Corinthians 1:26-27. Two, human might, power, military might, or one's political allies. People boast about this. They think that their allies are going to save them in crisis. We looked at this one earlier, Judges 7:2. This is where God does not deliver the Midianites into the hands of the army because He wants to preclude the tendency of Israel to brag about their own accomplishments. Well, we won this battle. So God takes... So basically, he whittles them down. How many people does God need to win a battle? Well, let's ask David. One? Are you kidding me? Obviously, that wasn't the entire battle there with Goliath. But, you know, the Philistines had to be pretty disheartened. That has to have a big effect on your military when your champion, 9'6½ giant, gets killed by a little red-headed ginger. And that's what David was. He was a little red-headed freckle boy. And wasn't very old at that time. And he's standing out there and it looks ridiculous. David's probably, 5'4" or something? And here's Goliath, 9'6", standing out there bellowing. The head of his spear was probably bigger just about than David, weighed more than David did. And he could throw this thing like you wouldn't believe. I mean, it was huge. He said the shaft of it was like a weaver's bead. What, like a 4x4? What are we talking about here? So, did God need all that? Well, what he does here in verse 3, he said, anybody that's trembling and afraid, let him return. So 22,000 people left out of 32,000. If you don't want to fight, go, okay, I'm going home. I'm going home. That is it. I don't want to fight. So 10,000 remain. And the Lord said, that's still too many. And Gideon's probably got to be thinking, what? You've reduced my fighting force by about a third. So there are too many. So bring them down to the water and I'll test them. And so finally, when he gets all this done, he has 300 people. And he takes his force of 300 people and defeats a overwhelming superior force and all of that. And why? To avoid human arrogance and in their military power. Psalm chapter 20, verse 7. So, again, this has been one of the problems of the United States. Of course, you get so much disinformation and you're fed so much junk, misinformation, disinformation. How often do you see these people? And of course, this is just Memorial Day, so I know you had to see all this. We are honoring the dead. Do you think they care? My guess is the dead don't. Now, if we could interview them, what do these parades mean to you out here in the cemetery? Nothing. And of course, you hear this constant refrain. People who've kept our country safe. First, we've never been attacked. I mean, we were in World War II, but our government knew about that. You don't want to check into that. They knew Pearl Harbor was coming. They let it happen. They wanted us in that war. War is big business, and our government is good at it. And we support Boeing and Lockheed and all these people and the war machine because there's lots and lots of money in it. And so we've never been attacked. Nobody's ever set foot on our shore. We're being invaded. But not in a military fashion. We're having our culture destroyed from within. In the name of, we're open-minded and we accept anybody and everybody, no matter how weird they are. That we've got to just accept all this. Even when it's not in the best interest of our country anymore. While it's controversial and I may not agree with everything he does, to put travel bans on militant Muslims doesn't bother me in the slightest. Does not bother me one iota. And then they brainwash you with this, the military has kept our country safe. From what? Our military is not fighting here. Where is our military fighting? They're in Afghanistan. They're in Iraq. We'd be in Syria if we got the chance. They're all over the globe. But we're not fighting here to save us from something. But this is all just, again, misinformation, disinformation. Till people, I heard them yesterday, they're out doing all these protests. I saw on the news this morning. And three or four times you heard people say this. Well, we live in a democracy. No, we don't. But let's not trouble ourselves with the truth. Let's not forget that about a half or three quarters of our population don't know the difference between a democracy and a republic. And so they say, well, we're out getting things done because we're people that matter. Yeah. Sure you are. You're just blocking up traffic is all you're doing. So, again, we're here to promote, this big agenda. We lay a wreath every year at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. I don't think he cares. He gets a new one every year. Now, all the rest of the soldiers don't necessarily, but he does. And we remember, you know. So the fact is, our military has created real trouble. And this is what we boast in. And this is really the arrogance of the human, and particularly of America, is that we've never been defeated. I sit as a queen. I will never see sorrow or widowhood. I'm not like these other countries. And we're going to find out we are. And it's going to come in 1 hour of one day. Psalm chapter 20, verse 7. Some boast in chariots and some in horses. Now Apache helicopters and tanks and, stealth fighters. And this is what we boast in now. Not chariots and horses, as it were. We boast in our great military machine. That our country is never going to see any of these problems that these other countries do. In some cases, problems that we've created for them. Sure, they see problems. But we will boast in the name of the Lord our God. Psalm 52:1. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? Here, this is a masque of David when Doeg the Edomite came and told Saul that David has come to the house. Why do you boast in evil, O mighty man? The loving kindness of God endures all day long. And you can also see Isaiah 25. Wealth and the details of life. People are impressed with people that have money, that live in certain places. I'm not. Job 31. As Paul said, if we have food and clothing, food and covering, with this we'll be content. So I don't have to live in the biggest house, in the biggest neighborhood. If you live in a big house in a big neighborhood, I don't care. That's fine. Good for you. I'm happy for you. I don't need to. None of us need to. We could live in smaller, and probably most all of us have lived in places that are not as nice as the ones we have now. As we grew up, you know, you get more prosperity as you go and all that, so you're able to live in a nicer place. Well, that's good. And I don't begrudge any believer anything. I mean, if you end up living out on Longboat Key in a gated mansion, I don't care. You know, just stay faithful to class. I don't want you moving out there and you say, well, it's too far a drive. Too hard to get off the island. Well, no, okay, then maybe you shouldn't live out there, okay? Now, not because I'm against you having a big house. I don't care. But be wise about it. So here, Job 31:24. If I have put my confidence in gold and called fine gold my trust, if I have gloated because my wealth was great, and because my hand had secured so much. And he says at the end of this, he keeps on going on here, but in verse 38 or 28, he says, that too would have been iniquity. That, and essentially saying that these things are sinful and people shouldn't do them. But if I do this, it's sin for me too. It's not just not a sin because you're a great believer and you can get away with it. Also, Psalm 49:6. So, again, people have confidence. Here, even those who trust in their wealth. And see, people have the idea, if I have enough money, I'll be secure, I'll be happy. No, you won't. Because as he said so well in that movie, Wall Street, it's never enough. It's never enough. I don't see people in the stock market say, well, I've made enough money, I'm not going to play anymore. We're rich now. We can just quit. Man, people don't quit. You see people, I go to the casino and they'll be up. Let's say they go in there and they're up $100,000 or something. Do they quit? No, they'll sit there until they lose it all back. I've watched people do this. And the reality is, people, if they get it, they may just blow through it anyway. And money doesn't make you secure, because God can hit you in places money doesn't help. You want to live in some chronic pain, your money, it won't matter how much money you've got. God knows how to get to us. He knows where we live. He knows how to make it sting. And we, again, ideally, we don't put him in that position. We just walk in doctrine and the truth and let God bless us rather than having him as our enemy working against us. And so, again, he can either grease your skids and make it easy and nice on you or make it difficult. We saw there, Jeremiah, we've seen that one. 1 John 2:16 talks about, and this was an important verse, 1 John, the New Testament there. Actually, it starts in 15. Do not love the world. The cosmic system is what he's talking about. The organized, structured world out there that people, unbelievers, live all the time. They live under the authority of Satan. They advance his agenda. They hold to his viewpoint. They are comfortable with this. They would be uncomfortable in here. They wouldn't like this, because this is anti-Satan viewpoint. This is undoing everything the cosmos believes in. So don't love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, here you got a third class condition. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. But if he does, if anyone loves the world, again, these are objective genitives. The believer is loving the world as its object. The love of the Father, again, another objective genitive. Don't claim to love God and be out here hobnobbing in the cosmos, associating with people that are negative. I don't care if they're friends, relatives, acquaintances, business associates, whoever they are, and then claim that that's God blessing you. That's not it. You're not loving God if you do that. That's not God's plan. Also, verse 16, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh. The flesh salivates lust out of the genetic sin nature. We all have one. Now, what lust your flesh salivates are different than what lust mine salivates. Some people have a tendency towards a particular sin or sinful activity. And it's genetic. The Bible talks about liars. They go astray from the womb. They're literally born liars. You've heard that phrase, born liar. And people have certain trends. Some people have a tendency towards sex, money, power, whatever, approbation, whatever they want. Hedonism, various kinds of lust that the flesh salivates. But the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes. People see things. How does lust work? Number one of the biggest ways, it comes through the eye socket. You have to see stuff. This is why they're constantly parading things before you in commercials that you need to see. They never show you when they're advertising the Mercury Continental or whatever it is. They don't show you a beat up old version of that, do they? They don't show you, they get Matthew McConaughey. I drive a Lincoln, And they don't get, some fat, ugly woman to sit in there and say, hey, I drive a Lincoln. They try to find an attractive person to represent their deal. And they're constantly bombarding your eye with stuff that's pretty. Ooh, look, keys, And in that way, the human race is much more not than a bunch of cats. You can just entertain them with this. Jump. And people fall for this all the time. And they're but constantly, you got to have something new. Something's better. The new improved version. So I told him yesterday, whatever we decide to do, I need one of these for my house. Now, that's not just a blatant plea for a new TV either. No, I don't really need one. I'm teasing. How do you say I need a 70-inch flat screen? We needed it for Bible class. That was legitimate, I thought. But and then God blessed it, because I found out that after we got it that they lowered the price a couple $100 and they had to give us it back. So that was good. So we even got a good deal on it. So the lust that comes through the eye gate. What is it? Clothing, jewelry, the thing, shiny stuff, neat stuff.
New cars, new houses, new details. I know I'll be happy if I get this one. This will be it, Lord. This will put me over the top. And then 6 months later, 6 weeks later, 6 days later, oh, I'm not happy anymore. It didn't satisfy. And the boastful pride of life. And this is biological life. The word here is not zoe, it's bios. It's what people can produce because of their biological abilities. The pride that comes out of that. Look what I've done. Look at my accomplishments, my achievements. That type of thing. He said, it's not from the Father, but it's from the world. And the world is constantly in a state of flux. It's passing away. This world, you're going to look around one day, 50 years, 100 years, we don't know exactly when. We think the end's closer than that. But wherever we are, whether we're in the millennium or in the eternal state, you're going to look around one day and this cosmic system's going to be gone. It is literally the end of the world as we know it. That's where we are. But people are woefully unprepared for what's about to happen. They've got no clue about the wrath of God. They don't want to think about it. And they kind of hope if they keep ignoring it, it'll go away. But it's not going to. It's not going to. And this is why if people want to get saved, we say, you better get saved now. But that's always been the day. Now is the day of salvation. Today is the accepted time. That's the way it always should be. So the world is passing away. And it's lust. And you're going to look around, they're going to be gone. I don't care how great Elon Musk is, he's going to die and go to hell if he's not a believer. And I don't care how great anybody else is, whatever monuments they built to themselves, or that reflect their genius or whatever else, it's all going to pass away. You remember, there used to be seven wonders of the ancient world. Can anybody take me to the Hanging Gardens today? No? How about the Colossus at Rhodes? Not there? No. Everything passes away. The great achievements, look at the pyramids. They're in disrepair, the Sphinx. This stuff's all passing away. Eventually, it'll all pass away. God's going to wipe the thing clean, in fact. And we'll live in a world where righteousness dwells. Not the kind of world we live in now. So there, also 1 John. So boasting, point 4 about the supposed control one has over the future. Proverbs 27. We saw the one there in James about boasting about what you're going to do, how much money you're going to make, what you're going to do, and all of that. Just a straightforward command here. Do not boast about tomorrow, for you do not know what a day will bring forth. And you really don't. Nobody does. Let's look at Luke there, Luke 12 also. He told them a parable, saying, the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no place to store my crops? This is what I'll do. I'll tear down my barns and build bigger barns. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. But God said to him, you fool, this very night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have prepared? Read Ecclesiastes. An idiot will own it, most likely. That generally, he says, what happens when I die and a fool inherits all my hard work? And that was a good book for me because I'd been one that was always tended to be real frugal. I always saved. I didn't go out and spend stuff if I didn't have to. And in fact, I never spent hardly anything on myself at all unless I had to. And so, and Linda can vouch for this. You couldn't pry the wallet open with the jaws of life, you know, kind of deal. But I got to Ecclesiastes and I thought, you know, he's right. Who am I saving all this for? And why am I saving all? Now, I'm not saying don't be stupid and go out and spend all your money and don't worry about tomorrow. But you got verses that you have to have a balance in your life with. Like, go to the ant, you sluggard. He plans ahead. So, yeah, there has to be a balance between planning ahead and being frugal and you know, all of this stuff. And you have to prepare. If you don't prepare for the future, you're a fool. The future's coming. Hello. I mean, unless you die in the next 5 minutes, you've got a future. And you better prepare for it. And telling people you're in the rapture generation, you don't need to worry about it. That's stupid. That is dumb. Because I know dead believers that lived in the rapture generation. And they did need to prepare for it. And they didn't. And that's not good. So, again, you don't know what's ever going to happen. And this idea, we'll just tear it down and build bigger. That's the answer that people have a lot of the time. Now, you'll watch people do that with their homes. They'll tear it down and build a bigger one. And more stuff on it. Well, okay. And then James, we saw that one about the people who want to travel. Religious activity not based on the principles of sound doctrine. People foolishly boast about things that God's not even impressed with. Deuteronomy 29, 18 and 19. Although God's not impressed with any of their human boasting, frankly. So that there will not be, he warns them that... not to follow the abominations of the nations that were getting run out before them. That obviously part of the reason these nations got jammed. People say, well, why did God take all that land and give it to the Jews? Well, that's what the question they should be asking. Most of them never ask it. And the answer is this: these people were pagan, horrible, sexual, disease-ridden degenerates in most cases. And this is why you wonder, well, why did God put certain cities under the ban when they took during the conquest? You go read the book of Joshua, like Jericho was put under the ban. You couldn't take anything. No booty was taken and no plunder. Why? Because this place was filled with disease and degenerates and a bunch of other things. Why did he wipe Sodom and Gomorrah off the planet? I think he was making a statement about what he thinks. But people don't want to acknowledge that the justice of God wipes these people out, and there's a reason for this. But what are the reasons? Well, these people were horrible. They engaged in abominations consistently, worshiping idols of wood, stone, and silver. And he warns them so that there will not be among you a man or woman or a family or a tribe whose heart turns away from the Lord your God to go and serve the gods of these nations. There will not be among you a root bearing poisonous fruit and wormwood. And it will be when he hears the words of this curse that he will boast, saying, I have peace, even though I walk in the stubbornness of my heart, in order to destroy the watered places with the dry. Well, guess what? If you walk in the stubbornness of your heart, good luck. You're going to need it. Because God's not impressed, and he knows how to break the stubborn. And he can do it. Again, my deal is, I think, unless they're positive, he may just let them go their own way. Let them go their own self-chosen path. And then let them end up dealing with the consequences. Because they're going to get old. And they're going to have health issues like everybody does. And they're going to face death. And when they face death, they're going to want to scream for God's help then. And God says straight out, I will laugh at you. I am not going to help you. I will laugh at you because you were arrogant. You didn't want my help when I offered it. I offered you help through sound doctrine and you wouldn't take it. You had a better way. You were smarter. You knew better. And he said, when the days come, when your terror comes like a tornado hitting you. How do tornadoes hit? Fast and violently. And God said, that's the kind of judgment I'm going to level on you. And you're going to scream bloody murder and I'm going to ignore you. And I'm going to just tell you good luck. Because that's all you're going to have is luck, because God's not going to help you. And people need, and again, this is frightening. People better get on top of this. This is how the world works. This is how God's plan works. So there you can also see Psalm 97:7. Let's look at Jeremiah 23. And so people engage in religious activity. Now, it may be bad religious activity, maybe idol worship, maybe traditions of men, human viewpoint, doctrines of demons, can be a lot of stuff. But they think activity, God's impressed with any activity. Well, he's not. Jeremiah 23, 32. Behold, I am against those who have prophesied false dreams, declares the Lord. And they related them and led my people astray by their falsehoods and reckless boasting. Yet I did not send them or command them, nor do they furnish this people the slightest benefit, declares the Lord. And then a lot of religious activity. But what benefit is it? What's it accomplishing? And is God in it? It has to be the bigger question. And the only authorized environment that I know of that he's for, that we can point to the Bible and say plainly, is the local church. It is the classroom of Christianity. It is the pillar and support of the truth. It is the environment in which we learn doctrine and grow up and apply. The parameters of our service are largely within this body. So tolerating evil in the name of grace, that's one of the things people boast about. I've heard this excessive emphasis on grace to the point where righteousness just takes it in the neck frequently. You cannot emphasize grace at the expense of righteousness. God didn't. Look at the cross. Why the cross? Because he couldn't exercise grace apart from righteousness being fulfilled. The penalty for sins had to be paid. And his son paid it. But God didn't just look the other way and say, well, I'm going to grace you out no matter what you do. And I've heard people make that statement. You'll never go wrong with gracing someone out. Sounds good on the surface. But can you prove that to me? No. It just sounds good. And so people tend to say it and embrace it without thinking about it. You could grace somebody out when they really need a good swift kick in the butt. Paul said, or you know, one of the things he said was, in terms of the pastor, you have to reprove, rebuke, and exhort. That isn't always just being nice, nice, nice. It's pointing out errors and letting people know, hey, if we're going to fight this fight and run this thing to the end and succeed as a local church, and I fully believe that in the last days there aren't going to be a lot of local churches that are still moving at the end, are still advancing and holding fast the truth that was delivered to us. And so I want to be one of those. I don't know about you, but I do. And I figure, what have I got to lose, really? I was a lost unbeliever on my way to hell when he found me. It's not like I had a whole lot going on. So why not strive for excellence? What have I got to lose? You know, it's like, you know, now this time of year you're getting it. You know, you get the College World Series and the Women's Softball World Series and all that. And, you know, once you're in there, go for broke. You know, there's a bunch of teams not playing. You are. So that's, again, it's our time on the stage. Well, it is actually reported here that there is immorality among you. An immorality of such a kind that does not even exist among the Gentiles. That someone has married his father's wife. You have become arrogant and have not mourned, so that the one who had done this deed would remove from your midst. He should have been excommunicated for this public behavior. Flagrant, public, sinful behavior that was even the kind that unbelievers looked at and went, ew. Gross. People don't normally do this. And the way it's worded here has led almost all interpreters uniformly to say that this was not his mother, this was his stepmother. Okay, well, that's better. No, it's not. This is disturbing. Local churches shouldn't tolerate this type of behavior. And yet, I ran across those people out there, and this was some church I ran across up in Tennessee, and they had this husband and wife. They weren't husband and wife. They were living together out of wedlock, and he was a deacon in their church. Well, what does that tell me? To me, that speaks volume. The leadership of that church doesn't know anything about the Bible, apparently. That speaks volumes if you've got that sort of a person in leadership. No, we're not going to tolerate that. So he says, you're arrogant. You should have been mourning about this. You should have been praying. You should have ejected the guy, and you didn't. So I'm going to do it. And so Paul steps in, uses apostolic authority, and says, toss him now. This isn't up for debate. We're not going to have a meeting about this. This is it. I'm using my authority, and this guy goes until he changes his mind. And some have suggested, well, maybe he wasn't married. Maybe he was just living with her. Well, and some have even suggested, well, even though it's immoral and God's against it, if he just marries her, that'll make it okay. I don't think so. If he's against it at any level, he's against it. And I've watched people do this, run out and, you know, if I just marry him, I'll be okay. Well, you may take some heat off your head, but I don't know that that makes it okay. So I don't think Paul was telling these people, hey, if he'll just marry the guy, we can forget about this. Or the girl, the guy. He wouldn't have been saying that, I know. That he wouldn't have said. Just let him marry him, get married, make it legal, and we'll be all fine with this. As if morality is determined by what the state of Florida says. Or the state of Oklahoma or Arizona or pick any state. No, morality is not determined by that. Morality is determined by what God says is moral. And if it's immoral, it's immoral whether people think it is or not. So there, that's tolerating evil in the name of grace. No, we're not going to tolerate evil and stupidity in the name of grace. We believe in grace fully. We're completely committed to that. The plan of God, the title and policy of his plan is grace. And salvation is strictly by grace. Even phase 2 achievements are by grace. But We also recognize that this has to be accompanied with a qualifying view to righteousness. Or phase two sanctification is no issue then if righteousness doesn't matter. I mean, we're as good as we are when we're saved, and that's as good as we ever need to be. I don't think that's what the Bible teaches. I think we have to grow in grace and righteousness and all and truth and these other things. Well, 7, alleged doctrinal superiority. 1 Corinthians 4, 7. And he's actually chiding the Corinthians. He's being sarcastic here. For who regards you as superior? Well, they did. We regard ourselves as superior was the answer, the unspoken answer here. And Paul knows this. Well, what do you have that you did not receive? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you have not received it? So he's basically telling them that where did you get your doctrine from? And this is something every believer, every pastor, all the way through the whole church had better never forget. Where did I come from? How did I get here? And if you owe a debt of gratitude to someone who taught doctrine for years, okay, fine. You should. I'm smart enough to recognize, although they were imperfect, I stand on the shoulders of men like Theme and Jack. But again, I've eliminated a lot of their nonsense out of the doctrine too. They taught nonsense, frankly. Called it the good deposit, but they should have called it the good somewhat deposit. Because it's got a little nonsense in it. It's got a lot of nonsense in it. Overblown ideas of authority. Abusing separation in the name of a club. Using that. No. We hold to high standards, I give you that. But this business of you can do anything you want. You're not in the Hotel California. I've seen doctrinal pastors do this. It's all fine if you move to my church, but you can't leave. You know, it's all fine if a believer goes to another church. But if they come here, well, that's horrible. So I'm not playing that game. Believers have to determine their own deal. And my guess, and we were talking about this at break, and it's been a view that I think most of us have had for a long time. And that is, I need to get to the place where I can get the soundest, purest form of teaching and maximize in these last days. That's what I need to do. And that's where you need to go. And if somebody's doing it better out there than me, I say go to them. Go do it. But make sure they're doing it better than I am. Because I'll look at their work and I can give you some input. Man, hopefully none of you are out there looking around. But this is a part of the deal in the local church. It's been overplayed. Is the local church like a marriage? Yes, Paul uses this analogy. I'm the husband, you guys are the wife. So, yes, I have the authority in the deal, but it's a partnership. It's not just, I beat you with a club and you do what I say. We could do that. I'm not necessarily against it. I am against it. I'm kidding. Again, I'm being facetious. I am against that. That's not the way a church is meant to be run. So you want to use your authority to help people, to help them grow, and all of that. Not to run roughshod over them. That's not why we're here. So why do you boast about it? So I don't forget where I came from. That's not lost on me. And I have a certain amount of gratitude and loyalty to the teaching I've received. But I also recognize some of it's nuts and needed to be changed. But the Bible, I say I recognized it. I didn't. The text forced me into it. It put me in these positions where I was forced to look at the doctrines as we were teaching them and see that they were wrong. Now, the fig tree was another huge one. All that's completely wrong, in fact. But if you don't do the book of Mark, you're not going to figure it out, I don't think. Same way here in Romans, there's certain things you're not going to figure out if you don't do this book. Thus, the challenge to keep moving through books, to keep exposing yourself to new material so that you do these things. Well, I still have plenty to teach, so I'm not in any trouble at that point. So their alleged doctrinal superiority. You Corinthians think you're so great. Are you really, in fact, so great? And the answer was no, they're not. Men, particularly communicators, which often leads to sectarianism. Again, I've told you repeatedly over the years, don't run out of here and say, Ron says. Your loyalty's not to me. Your loyalty's to the truth. Now, there's a legitimate loyalty and a camaraderie the pastor has with the congregation. That's okay. That's not what we're talking about. But at the end of the day, I can't get up and say, you owe me because I'm the only one who's ever taught you truth. Many of you have sat under other pastors and learned truth. Now, you may not have learned it at a high level. Hopefully, I'm doing a better job. But the fact is, you still did. And it'd be foolish to think that you didn't. Well, then people want to start taking sides. Your pastor cannot get into this mindset of you're either for me or against me. That's dangerous. Because believers are going to make mistakes. And but if you give them time, my belief is, like myself, if you give me time and sufficient exposure to the truth, I'll get with it. I want to get with it. I don't want to be an idiot. And I presume all of you are the same way. So you have to be patient. That's one of the things we're going to review, the whole concept of the local church coming up. The tolerance you have to have. And again, this is why face-to-face, you have to deal with believers that fail, that have warts, and all that. And you have to look at them and be nice to them, even if they've done you wrong. Now, let's try not to do each other wrong, okay? That's just a simple, you know, little rule of advice. Well, here, people boasting about their communicating. My pastor's better than yours. Let's avoid that. You know, that's what are you, six? My dad can beat your dad up. No, come on. That's a little juvenile. And we're not in competition. There's not a legitimate competition. I don't care what anybody else says. I want to do my job at the highest level possible. But I've always been that way. Not just about doctrine. Any job I did, I tried to do it to the best of my ability. This is what I was taught as a child. Have pride in yourself. And then this is when we're talking about legitimate pride. You know, do a good job. At the end of the day, when you've done a good job, and you may not have made a lot of money, but there's a satisfaction that goes with that. So this business of, I'm of Paul, he says. When one says, I'm of Paul, in other words, I'm a follower of Paul. I'm Paul's disciple. Oh, I'm Apollos' disciple. Are you not mere men? In other words, what he's saying here is, are you not just acting like unbelievers? Mere men here is an insult. What then is Apollos and what is Paul? Servants through whom you believed, even as the Lord gave opportunity to each one. I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth. So then neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but God who causes the growth. So again, we'll get our rewards based on our input, but we have to deal with this. And then verse 21 there at the end of that chapter. So then let no one boast in men. And so, you go out of here and say anything you want, but I would prefer you say the Bible teaches rather than Ron says. Because what Ron says is irrelevant unless it matches up to what the truth says. And so, again, we don't want to pit people against one another. Look, it's 12 o'clock. We better stop. I guess our time is gone. That went pretty quick. So I thought we had another 20 minutes, but I guess I was having too much fun. So hopefully you were too. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the time to fellowship together in the things of your plan. We pray that you would sanctify this information to our spiritual growth and glory, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.